Chapter 6 Symphony. I was never very good at drawing, so one week I decided to learn. But instead of enrolling in a conventional art class, I opted for an approach closer to the heart of this audiobook. Drawing on the right side of the brain, the method pioneered by Betty Edwards and described in her similarly titled book. In the process, I learned a lot about our next high-concept aptitude. Symphony, as they call this aptitude, is the ability to put together the pieces. It is the capacity to synthesize rather than to analyze, to see relationships between seemingly unrelated fields, to detect broad patterns rather than to deliver specific answers, and to invent something new by combining elements nobody else thought to pair. Symphony is also an attribute of the brain's right hemisphere in the literal as well as the metaphorical sense. As I explained in Chapter 2, the neuroscience research conducted with functional MRIs has shown that the right hemisphere operates in a simultaneous, contextual, and symphonic manner. It concerns itself not with a particular spruce, but with the whole forest. Not with the bassoon player or the first violinist, but with the entire orchestra. Symphonic thinking is a signature ability of composers and conductors, whose jobs involve corralling a diverse group of notes, instruments, and performers, and producing a unified and pleasing sound. Entrepreneurs and inventors have long relied on this ability, but today symphony is becoming an essential aptitude for a much wider swath of the population. The reasons go back to the three forces propelling us out of the information age. Automation has taken over many of the routine analytic tasks that knowledge workers once performed. Many of those tasks are also heading to Asia, where they can be done equally well for much less. That is freeing, and in some cases forcing, professionals to do what computers and low-wage foreign technicians have a much more difficult time replicating, recognizing patterns, crossing boundaries to uncover hidden connections, and making bold leaps of imagination. Meantime, a world teeming with information, individual choices, and just plain stuff is putting a premium on this aptitude in our personal lives as well. Modern life's glut of options and stimuli can be so overwhelming that those with the ability to see the big picture, to sort out what really matters, have a decided advantage in their pursuit of personal well-being. One of the best ways to understand and develop the aptitude of symphony is to learn how to draw, a skill that wasn't exactly my forte. On the morning of the first day of drawing class, before we open our sketchbooks or sharpen our pencils, we learn the essence of our craft, distilled to a single sentence that will be repeated for the next 5 days. Drawing, says Brian Baumeisler, is largely about relationships. Baumeisler is my instructor. He'll be teaching me and 6 other students, a far-flung group that includes a lawyer from the Canary Islands and a pharmacist from New Zealand, the techniques developed by Betty Edwards in Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. Baumeisler comes to the job with considerable street cred. He's an accomplished painter in New York. His works and works in progress adorn the walls of the 6th-floor Soho loft that will be our classroom. He's been teaching this course for 20 years. He's also Betty Edwards' son. Like his mother, with whom he developed this 5-day workshop, Baumeisler believes drawing is about seeing. The naming of things is where you get into trouble, he says. And to prove the point, as well as to benchmark our abilities, he gives us an hour to draw a self-portrait. We prop up our little mirrors, open our oversized sketchbooks, and begin to draw. I finish before the others, and Baumeisler immediately identifies me as the 400-pound cheese doodle fiend making his inaugural visit to Weight Watchers. I've got a long way to go, but since things can't get much worse, they'll likely get a little better. My problem, Baumeisler tells me as he squints at my artwork, is that I'm not drawing what I'm seeing. I'm drawing what he calls remembered symbols from childhood. The lips I've drawn don't really look like my lips. They don't really look like anybody's lips, in fact. I've drawn a symbol for lips, a symbol as a matter of fact that comes from my childhood. Those penciled lips look a lot like the Magicist sign that used to beckon from I-94 when, as a kid, My family drove to visit my grandparents in Chicago. In a sense, I've merely written L-I-P-S in modern hieroglyphics instead of truly seeing my lips and recognizing how they relate to the totality of my face. Later that first day, Bo Meisler shows us a Picasso line drawing and asks us to copy it. But before we begin, he tells us to turn Picasso's sketch upside down. So, you know nothing about what you're drawing. The goal is to trick the left hemisphere and clear the way for the right. When the left brain doesn't know what the right brain is doing, the mind is free to see relationships and to integrate those relationships into a whole. In many ways, this is the core of learning how to draw, as well as the key to mastering the aptitude of symphony. For example, one of the reasons my self-portrait at first looked so strange is that the relationships were skewed. In class, we seven students learn, and more important, we see that on a human face, the distance from the center line of the eyes to the bottom of the chin is equal to the distance from the center line of the eyes to the top of the head. I drew my eyes much higher on the head than they are in reality, and by botching that one relationship, I distorted the entire picture. Bo Meisler is a sympathetic teacher with the gentle manner of Mr. Rogers, had Mr. Rogers done time on Paris's left bank. During each drawing exercise, he glides around the room offering encouragement. "I'm here to keep your left hemisphere quiet," he murmurs. One day, he teaches us about negative space, that is, the area between and around an image. When we draw portraits of our classmates later in the week, we begin by lightly shading our large piece of paper and then erasing the part that's not the outline of our subject's head in order to reveal it. Negative space is a powerful drawing tool, Bo Meisler says. It's one of the secrets to learning how to draw. Over the next 4 days, we learn to see several of these relationships, between space and negative space, between light and shadow, between angles and proportions, in ways that many of us never noticed. We draw stools propped on tables, the wrinkles on our hands, and the shadows that caress the corners of Bo Meisler's studio. Throughout, Bo Meisler repeats his mantra that drawing is largely about relationships that, when combined, create the whole. And so, in some sense, is this course. All of our exercises in relationships lead to the final afternoon, when we must integrate our newly acquired understanding into a big picture, a second attempt at a self-portrait. Seeing relationships. Like drawing, symphony is also largely about relationships. People who hope to thrive in the conceptual age must understand the connections between diverse and seemingly separate disciplines. They must know how to link apparently unconnected elements to create something new. And they must become adept at analogy, at seeing one thing in terms of another. There are ample opportunities, in other words, for three types of people: the boundary crosser, the inventor, and the metaphor maker. The boundary crosser. What's the most prevalent and perhaps most important prefix of our times? Multi. Our jobs require multitasking. Our communities are multicultural. Our entertainment is multimedia. While detailed knowledge of a single area once guaranteed success, today the top rewards go to those who can operate with equal aplomb in starkly different realms. I call these people boundary crossers. They develop expertise in multiple spheres, they speak different languages, and they find joy in the rich variety of human experience. They live multi-lives because that's more interesting and nowadays more effective. Boundary crossers are people like Andy Tuck, a philosophy professor and pianist who applies the skills he honed in those fields to run his own management consulting firm. They include people such as Gloria White Hammond, a pastor and pediatrician in Boston, Todd McOver, who composes operas and builds high-tech music equipment, and Jane Barnes, whose experience in mathematics informs her intricate clothing designs. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, the Claremont Graduate University psychologist who wrote the classic book Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience, as well as Creativity, Flow and the Psychology of Discovery and Invention, has studied the lives of creative people and found that creativity generally involves crossing the boundaries of domains. The most creative among us see relationships the rest of us never notice. Such ability is at a premium in a world where specialized knowledge work can quickly become routinized work and therefore be automated or outsourced away. Designer Clement Mock says, "The next 10 years will require people to think and work across boundaries into new zones that are totally different from their areas of expertise. They will not only have to cross those boundaries, but they will also have to identify opportunities and make connections between them. For example, the offshoring of computer jobs to India will create new demand for people who can manage the relationship between the coders in the East and the clients in the West. Those home-minded professionals must be literate in two cultures, comfortable in both the hard science of computing and the soft science of sales and marketing, and able to move between different and sometimes antagonistic groups with the ease of a diplomat. Such multifaceted people can often solve problems that flummox the experts. Many engineering deadlocks have been broken by people who are not engineers at all," says Nicholas Negroponte of MIT. "This is because perspective is more important than IQ. The ability to make big leaps of thought is a common denominator among the originators of breakthrough ideas. Usually this ability resides in people with very wide backgrounds, multidisciplinary minds, and a broad spectrum of experiences." Boundary crossers reject either-or choices and seek multiple options and blended solutions. They lead hyphenated lives filled with hyphenated jobs and enlivened with hyphenated identities. They help explain the growing ranks of college students with double majors and the proliferation of academic departments that dub themselves interdisciplinary. Csikszentmihalyi has also uncovered a related dimension of the boundary crosser's talent. Those who possess it often elude traditional gender role stereotyping. In his research, he found that when tests of masculinity-femininity are given to young people, over and over one finds that creative and talented girls are more dominant and tough than other girls, and creative boys are more sensitive and less aggressive than their male peers. This bestows unique advantages, according to Csikszentmihalyi. A psychologically androgynous person, in effect, doubles his or her repertoire of responses and can interact with the world in terms of a much richer and varied spectrum of opportunities. In other words, as Samuel Taylor Coleridge said 200 years ago, and as boundary crossers remind us today, great minds are androgynous. The inventor. In the 1970s, Hershey Food Corporation ran a series of goofy television commercials that inadvertently contained a crucial lesson in R-directed thinking. In the ads, a person walks along dreamily while munching a chocolate bar. Someone else, equally oblivious, strolls about while eating peanut butter. The two collide. "Hey, you got peanut butter on my chocolate," the first person complains. "And you got chocolate on my peanut butter," the other replies. Each then samples the results. To their surprise, they discover they've created a masterpiece. "Reese's Peanut Butter Cups," the announcer intones. "Two great tastes that taste great together." R-directed thinkers understand the logic of this confectionery fender bender. They have an intuitive sense of what I call the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup theory of innovation. Sometimes the most powerful ideas come from simply combining two existing ideas nobody else ever thought to unite. Take John Fable, an avid cross-country skier. He loved the sport, but his backpack straps always bruised his shoulders. One day on a trip to New York, he passed by the Brooklyn Bridge and saw the solution to his problem. In an act of what two cognitive scientists call conceptual blending, Fable combined the structure of a suspension bridge with the components of a traditional backpack and invented a new, easier-to-tote and now popular pack called EcoTrek. The ability to forge these kinds of inspired inventive relationships is a function of the right side of our brains. Cognitive scientists at Drexel and Northwestern universities have found that the flashes of insight that precede aha moments are accompanied by a large burst of neural activity in the brain's right hemisphere. However, when we work out problems in a more methodical, L-directed way, this eureka center remains quiet. Our ability to activate this right hemisphere capacity has become more urgent as we transition out of the information age. In business today, the journey from innovation to commodity is so swift that successful individuals and organizations must be relentless. They must focus maniacally on invention while outsourcing or automating much of the execution. This requires those with the ability and fortitude to experiment with novel combinations and to make the many mistakes that inevitably come with an inspiration-centered approach. Fortunately, despite what some might believe, all of us harbor this capacity to invent. Listen to Trevor Bayliss, the British stuntman turned inventor who invented a wind-up radio that can be used without batteries or electricity. Invention isn't some impenetrable branch of magic. Anyone can have a go. Most inventions and breakthroughs come from reassembling existing ideas in new ways. Those willing to have a go at developing this symphonic ability will flourish in the conceptual age. The metaphor maker. Suppose you're at the office one day and your boss says, "Lend me your ears." As we learned in Chapter 1, because the literal meaning of those four words computes only in a gruesome way, the left hemisphere will get a bit panicky and look beseechingly across the corpus callosum for assistance. The right hemisphere will then calm its partner, put the phrase in context, and explain that "lend me your ears" is a metaphor. The boss doesn't really want you to pull a Van Gogh. He just wants you to listen to what he's about to say. Metaphor, that is, understanding one thing in terms of something else, is another important element of symphony. But like so many aspects of R-directed thinking, it struggles against an undeserved reputation. The Western tradition has excluded metaphor from the domain of reason, writes the prominent linguist George Lakoff. Metaphor is often considered ornamentation, the stuff of poets and other frilly sorts, flowery words designed to perfume the ordinary or unpleasant. In fact, metaphor is central to reason because, as Lakoff writes, human thought processes are largely metaphorical. In a complex world, mastery of metaphor, a whole-minded ability that some cognitive scientists have called imaginative rationality, has become ever more valuable. Each morning when we rise from our slumber and flick on the lights, we know we'll spend much of the day paddling through a torrent of data and information. Certain kinds of software can sort these bits and offer glimpses into patterns, but only the human mind can think metaphorically and see relationships that computers could never detect. Likewise, in a time of abundance, when the largest rewards go to those who can devise novel and compelling creations, metaphor making is vital. For instance, Georges de Mestral noticed how burrs stuck to his dog's fur and, reasoning metaphorically, came up with the idea for Velcro. A computer couldn't have done that. Everything you create is a representation of something else. In this sense, everything you create is enriched by metaphor, writes choreographer Twyla Tharp. She encourages people to boost their metaphor quotient, or MQ, because in the creative process, MQ is as valuable as IQ. Metaphorical thinking is also important because it helps us understand others. That's one reason that marketers are supplementing their quantitative research with qualitative investigations into the metaphorical minds of their customers. For instance, a method developed by Harvard Business School professor Gerald Zaltman supplements polls and focus groups by asking subjects to bring in pictures that describe their feelings toward particular goods and services, and then to fashion those pictures into a collage. Through this technique, Zaltman elicits the metaphors customers use to think of products. Coffee as an engine, a security gizmo as a companionable watchdog, and so on. But the benefits go well beyond the commercial realm. Today, thanks to astonishing improvements in telecommunications, wider access to travel, and increasing lifespans, we come into contact with a larger and more diverse set of people than any humans in history. Metaphorical imagination is essential in forging empathic connections and communicating experiences that others do not share. Finally, and perhaps most important, is metaphor's role in slaking the thirst for meaning. The material comforts brought forth by abundance ultimately matter much less than the metaphors you live by, whether, say, you think of your life as a journey or as a treadmill. A large part of self-understanding, says Lakoff, is the search for appropriate personal metaphors that make sense of our lives. The more we understand metaphor, the more we understand ourselves. Seeing the big picture. In any symphony, the composer and the conductor have a variety of responsibilities. They must make sure that the brass horns work in sync with the woodwinds, that the percussion instruments don't drown out the violas. But perfecting those relationships, important though it is not the ultimate goal of their efforts. What conductors and composers desire, what separates the long remembered from the quickly forgotten, is the ability to marshal these relationships into a whole whose magnificence exceeds the sum of its parts. So it is with the high concept aptitude of symphony. The boundary crosser, the inventor, and the metaphor maker all understand the importance of relationships. But the conceptual age also demands the ability to grasp the relationships between relationships. This meta-ability goes by many names: systems thinking, gestalt thinking, holistic thinking. I prefer to think of it simply as seeing the big picture. Seeing the big picture is fast becoming a killer app in business. While knowledge workers of the past typically performed piecemeal assignments and spent their days tending their own patch of a larger garden, such work is now moving overseas or being reduced to instructions in powerful software. As a result, what has become more valuable is what fast computers and low-paid overseas specialists cannot do nearly as well: integrating and imagining how the pieces fit together. This has become increasingly evident among entrepreneurs and other successful business people. For instance, one remarkable recent study found that self-made millionaires are 4 times more likely than the rest of the population to be dyslexic. Why? Dyslexics struggle with L-directed thinking and the linear, sequential, alphabetic reasoning at its core. But as with a blind person who develops a more acute sense of hearing, a dyslexic's difficulties in one area lead him to acquire outsized ability in others. As Sally Shaywitz, a Yale neuroscientist and specialist in dyslexia, writes, "Dyslexics think differently. They are intuitive and excel at problem-solving, seeing the big picture, and simplifying. They are poor rote reciters, but inspired visionaries." Game changers such as Charles Schwab, who invented the discount brokerage, and Richard Branson, who has shaken up the music and airline industries, both cite dyslexia as a secret to their success. It forced them to see the big picture. Because of their difficulty analyzing the particulars, they became adept at recognizing the patterns. Michael Gerber, who has studied entrepreneurs of all sorts, has reached similar conclusions. All great entrepreneurs are systems thinkers. All who wish to become great entrepreneurs need to learn how to become systems thinkers, to develop their innate passion for seeing things whole. Both academic studies and firsthand observations are showing that pattern recognition, understanding the relationships between relationships, applies with equal force to those who aren't intent on building their own empire. Daniel Goleman writes about a study of executives at 15 large companies. "Just one cognitive ability distinguished star performers from average: pattern recognition, the big picture thinking that allows leaders to pick out the meaningful trends from a welter of information around them and to think strategically far into the future." These star performers, Goleman found, relied less on deductive if-then reasoning and more on the intuitive, contextual reasoning characteristic of symphony. The shifting terrain is already prompting some archetypal L-directed workers to recast who they are and what they do. One example: Stephanie Quain of Seattle, who calls herself a holistic attorney, dedicated to taking care of your will, trust, and family matters by viewing them in context rather than isolation and examining how your legal concerns relate to the entirety of your life. More and more employers are looking for people who possess this aptitude. Sidney Harmon is one of them. The 80-something multimillionaire CEO of a stereo components company says he doesn't find it all that valuable to hire MBAs. Instead, "I say, get me some poets as managers. Poets are our original systems thinkers. They contemplate the world in which we live and feel obliged to interpret and give expression to it in a way that makes the reader understand how that world turns. Poets, those unheralded systems thinkers, are our true digital thinkers. It is from their midst that I believe we will draw tomorrow's new business leaders. Business and work, of course, are far from the only places where seeing the big picture is helpful. This aspect of Symphony has also become crucial for health and well-being. Take the growing appeal of integrative medicine, which combines conventional medicine with alternative and complementary therapies, and its cousin holistic medicine, which aims to treat the whole person rather than the particular disease. These movements, grounded in science but not dependent solely on science's often L-directed approach, have achieved mainstream recognition, including their own branch of the National Institutes of Health. They move beyond the reductionist, mechanistic approach of conventional medicine toward one that, in the words of one physician's professional association, integrates all aspects of well-being, including physical, environmental, mental, emotional, spiritual, and social health, thereby contributing to the healing of ourselves and our planet. The capacity to see the big picture is perhaps most important as an antidote to the variety of psychic woes brought forth by the remarkable prosperity and plentitude of our times. Many of us are crunched for time, deluged by information, and paralyzed by the weight of too many choices. The best prescription for these modern maladies may be to approach one's life in a contextual big-picture fashion, to distinguish between what really matters and what merely annoys. As I'll discuss in the final chapter, this ability to perceive one's own life in a way that encompasses the full spectrum of human possibility is essential to the search for meaning. On the final day of drawing class, we approach the week's crescendo. After lunch, we each tape our small mirrors to the wall. We position our chairs about 8 inches away and begin to draw our self-portraits once again. Baumeister warns us of the perils lurking in the looking glass. We've used the mirror to prepare ourselves to face the world. Clear your mind of any thoughts you've had about that and concentrate on the shapes, the lights, and the relationships, he says. You want to see what your face looks like on this particular day, in this particular place. At lunch, I swap my glasses for contact lenses so I won't have to draw the shadows cast by my spectacles. Given my performance on the first self-portrait, I'll take any edge I can get. I begin with my eyes, really looking at them, seeing what shape they are, where the color ends and the whites of my eyeballs begin, realizing that the width between my two eyes is exactly the same as the width of each individual eye. My nose, though, gives me fits, in part because I keep thinking of a nose instead of just seeing what's plain on my face. I skip that part, and for the longest time, my self-portrait has a big empty spot in the center, a Venus de Milo of proboscises. When I get to the mouth, I draw and redraw it 9 times until I get it right, because the early renditions keep looking like that magicist sign. But the shape of the head comes easily, because I just erase the negative space around it. To my amazement, what emerges on the sketchpad begins to look a little like me on that particular day, in that particular place. Baumeister checks in on my progress, touches my shoulder, and whispers, "Fantastic." I almost believe he means it, and as I pencil in the finishing touches, I experience a tiny hint of the kind of feeling a terrified mother must have after she's lifted a Buick off her child and wonders where her strength came from. When I'm done, after seeing the relationships and integrating those relationships into the big picture, the portrait is much, much better. Symphony Portfolio. Listen to the great symphonies. Listening to symphonies, not surprisingly, is an excellent way to develop your powers of symphony. Here are 5 classics the experts recommend. Of course, particular recordings with different conductors and orchestras will vary in style, interpretation, and sound. Beethoven's 9th Symphony. One of the most famous symphonies of all time, Beethoven's Ode to Joy, is always a treat. I've found that on each listening, something new surfaces, in part because the context in which I've listened alters and shapes the meaning. Mozart's number 35, the Haffner Symphony. Notice how Mozart brings in the woodwinds at the end to create a whole that dramatically surpasses the sum of the parts. Mahler's fourth symphony in G major. I doubt that inspiration was Mahler's aim, but his fourth symphony always sounds inspiring to me. Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. You've heard this one many times before, but next time, get a recording that uses actual church bells and cannons, and listen carefully to how the components fit together. Haydn's number 94 in G major, the Surprise Symphony. To master the aptitude of symphony, you must be open to surprise. When you listen to this, marvel at how Haydn uses surprise to broaden and deepen the music. Hit the newsstand. One of my favorite exercises in conceptual blending is the newsstand roundup. If you're stymied on how to solve a problem or just want to freshen your own thinking, visit the largest newsstand you can find. Spend 20 minutes browsing and select 10 publications that you've never read and would likely never buy. That's the key. Buy magazines you never noticed before. Then take some time to look through them. You don't have to read every page of every magazine, but get a sense of what the magazine is about and what its readers have on their minds. Then look for connections to your own work or life. For instance, when I did this exercise, I figured out a better way to craft my business cards thanks to something I saw in Cake Decorating Magazine, and came up with a new idea for a newsletter because of an article in a magazine called Hair for You. One warning, your spouse might give you uncomfortable looks when you come home toting Trailer Life, Teen Cosmo, and Divorce Magazine. Another suggestion, draw. A great way to expand your capacity for symphony is to learn how to draw. As I discovered myself, drawing is about seeing relationships and then integrating those relationships into a whole. I'm partial to the Betty Edwards approach because it proved so valuable to me. About a dozen times a year, Brian Baumeisler and other Edwards disciples teach courses like the one I took. If you can spare the time, the 5-day workshop is well worth the investment. If you can't, Edwards and Baumeisler have a Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain video. And Edwards' classic book, Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain, is available at most booksellers. For more information, go online to www.drawright.com. For those of you with more curiosity than patience, consider playing around with a 5-line self-portrait, that is, drawing your self-portrait using only 5 lines. It's a great big picture exercise and plenty of fun. Keep a metaphor log. Improve your MQ, your metaphor quotient, by writing down compelling and surprising metaphors you encounter. Try it for a week, and you'll understand the power of this exercise. Keep a small notebook with you and scribble when you read a newspaper columnist write that pollsters have colonized the minds of our leaders, or when your friend says, "I don't feel rooted." You'll be amazed. When I last kept a log, I came up with such an array of metaphors that the world seemed richer and more vivid. It will also inspire you to create your own metaphors in writing, thought, or other parts of your life. Another exercise, follow the links. Play your own version of 6 degrees of separation courtesy of the internet. Choose a word or topic you find interesting, type it into a search engine, and then follow the links. From the initial site you visit, select one of its links and venture on. Repeat this process 7 or 8 times, always clicking a new link from the site you're currently viewing. At the end of your journey, reflect on what you learned about your original topic and the diversions you encountered along the way. What did you encounter because of your casual detours that you might otherwise not have found? What patterns or themes, if any, emerged? What unusual connections between seemingly unrelated thinking did you accidentally discover? Following the links is a commitment to learning by serendipity. A variation, go with pure chance by using a random website generator like YouRoulette, www.YouRoulette.com, or Random Web Search, www.randomwebsearch.com. Beginning with a site you never would have visited can take you to places you never expected and enhance your appreciation for the symphonic relationships between ideas. Look for solutions in search of problems. Problems need solutions. That's elementary. But sometimes smart solutions need a few more problems. In their lively and engaging book, Why Not? How to Use Everyday Ingenuity to Solve Problems Big and Small, Yale professors Barry Nailbuff and Ian Ayers suggest we examine existing solutions and ask two questions. 1. Where else would it work? Sometimes we can export fixes from one realm to another. For instance, the authors ask, if the movie industry can create a PG version of its films to show on airplanes, why not offer the same recut and sanitized version on DVD for parents concerned about what their kids are watching? If U.S. taxpayers can make deductible IRA contributions past the tax year and until April 15th, why not permit the same for charitable deductions and allow people to make more informed choices about their generosity? 2. Would flipping it work? Changing the default option is a simple step that can achieve excellent results. Consider organ donation. In the U.S., Nailbuff and Ayers write, potential donors must affirmatively indicate their desire to donate their organs. Although polls show most Americans are willing to do so, inertia and circumstance often stand in the way. But if organ donation were opt-out instead of opt-in, that is, when people applied for their driver's licenses, they were automatically signed up unless they explicitly said they didn't want to become an organ donor, as is the practice in several other countries, the U.S. would chip away at lengthy transplant waiting lists and save thousands of lives. Asking why can lead to understanding. Asking why not can lead to breakthroughs. There's more information on the web at www.whynot.net. Another suggestion, create an inspiration board. When you're working on a project, empty your bulletin board and turn it into an inspiration board. Each time you see something that you find compelling, a photo, a piece of fabric, the page of a magazine, tack it to the board. Before long, you'll start seeing connections between the images that will enliven and expand your work. Fashion designers have long used these boards, forming wild collages that serve as mind expanders and conceptual guides. You can do the same. Read these books. Here are 6 books to help you hone your powers of symphony. Beethoven's Anvil, Music in Mind and Culture by William Benson. An excellent exploration of how the mind processes music, in particular, how music draws on all parts of the brain in a whole-minded, symphonic fashion. Powers of Ten, by Charles and Ray Ames. Created by the well-known husband-wife team, this flip book contains 76 pages, each with one image, each of which is seen 10 times closer than its predecessor. Start at the beginning of the book with an image of the Earth viewed from 10 million light-years away. Then, flip through the pages with your thumb and zero in on a man at a picnic on Chicago's lakefront, and descend into the man's skin, one of the skin's cells, the cell's DNA, all the way to a single proton. Dialogue, The Art of Thinking Together by William Isaacs. Collaborating with colleagues to cross boundaries, identify patterns, and connect ideas may require new ways of talking with each other. This book explores principles and practices that can help individuals move beyond simply reporting their own thoughts to truly thinking together and building collective wisdom. Metaphors We Live by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. This short, accessible work is the best book available about metaphor as a thought process. How to See, A Guide to Reading Our Man-Made Environment by George Nelson. First published in the mid-70s and reissued in 2003, This book is an amazing tutorial in looking critically at the world around us, making connections between what we see, and conceiving of human creations in a broader context. Do some real brainstorming. You've been in this meeting. The boss asks everyone to brainstorm. And after 15 frustrating minutes, the effort produces few inspired ideas and many dispirited employees. Why does this happen? Because you weren't following the rules. Effective brainstorming sessions aren't random and haphazard. They follow a particular structure that's proven to elicit good ideas. To brainstorm properly, abide by these rules, which are drawn from Tom Kelly's excellent book, The 10 Faces of Innovation. 1. Go for quantity. Good ideas emerge from lots of ideas. Set a numerical goal, say a total of 100 ideas. 2. Encourage wild ideas. Extremism is a virtue. The right idea often flows from what initially seems outlandish. 3. Be visual. Pictures unlock creativity. 4. Defer judgment. There's no such thing as a bad idea, so banish the naysayers. Think creatively first and critically later. 5. One conversation at a time. Listen, be polite, and build on others' suggestions. As people shout out their ideas or expand others' thoughts, capture everything in writing. It helps to have one person serve as scribe and another as facilitator. At the end of a half hour, you'll have a long list of ideas. Take a break. Then begin evaluating what's on the list. Most of the ideas won't be very good. Some will be downright ridiculous. But it's almost certain that you'll come up with a handful of ideas you'd never have arrived at otherwise. If you want to brainstorm from your own private Idaho of a computer, check out the website Half Bakery, www.halfbakery.com. to which people around the world have contributed all manner of ideas for products, services, and businesses. Some of the ideas are raw, but others are surprisingly well done.